Welcome to the 23rd episode of Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Brandon Scalia. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. Onc Live is also home to the State of the Science Summits. These summits, which take place throughout the United States, are dedicated to the latest research in various therapeutic areas. That brings us to today's episode. In December 2018, we traveled to San Diego, California for the 2018 ASH Annual Meeting. At the conference, we spoke with several experts across hematologic malignancies, including mantle cell lymphoma, chronic lymphocytic leukemia, and multiple myeloma. While we were on site, we spoke to Tysel J. Phillips, MD, who is an assistant professor at the University of Michigan Cancer Center. During our time together, Phillips shed light on safety and efficacy findings for acalabrutinib plus bendamustine and rituximab in patients with treatment-naive or relapsed-refractory mantle cell lymphoma. At the meeting, Phillips reported encouraging efficacy rates with complete responses greater than 70% in treatment-naive patients. Listen below to hear how the toxicity profiles fared between groups.
Mantle cell lymphoma is a rare subset of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. It affects about 5 to 6% of all patients. It's typically very common in patients 65 and older with a preference of male patients. So as of currently, we don't have an official standard of care. And so a lot of research nowadays is trying to determine an optimal treatment regimen for patients, either in the transplant eligible population or the transplant ineligible population. As far as chemotherapy regimens, bendamustine and rituximab has been shown to be an effective regimen and well tolerated. And as we all know, in the relapsed refractory setting, the BTK inhibitors have also shown to be very effective. So in this study, in the two arms, one is evaluating the combination of acalabrutinib, which is a second generation BTK inhibitor, plus bendamustine and rituximab in treating naive patients. And also we're looking at this in a relapsed refractory setting to sort of see how the combination affects these patients as well. The hope is that obviously that this was a very safe and tolerable regimen, but also to improve upon the efficacy of both BR versus the BTK inhibitors alone. So it was a non-randomized study. So all patients received a standard dose of bendamustine and rituximab, dosed at 90 milligrams per meter squared, rituximab at 375 milligrams per meter squared. Bendamustine was given on day one and day two. Rituximab given on day one, and the acalabrutinib was dosed at the standard dose of 100 milligrams BID, and that was given throughout the study. In the treatment naive arm, patients were given the opportunity, they were transitioned to maintenance after initial treatment, given approximately 2 years of rituximab every 2 months. And also the acalabrutinib was continued to be dosed daily. In the relapsed refractory setting, patients were transitioned to just acalabrutinib as a single agent alone. So as far as the safety findings, the combination was deemed to be relatively safe. There were a few patients in both arms who were unable to complete the treatment. Most of these were not deemed to be thought to be related to the treatment itself, and most of the patients' performance status and comorbidities upon entering the study. As far as major AEs, obviously, infection with the bendamustine and rituximab was common, although we did not see any infections that were out of the norm for what we would expect. With the acalabrutinib, we did see a high subset of headaches, which seemed to be common with the regimen, but most of these headaches were tolerable and they seemed to subside with further treatment on the study. As far as efficacy rates, the efficacy rates, especially in the treatment-naive patient population, was fairly impressive. CR rates were greater than 70%. And in a relapsed refractory setting, again, we did not see a difference in AE rates between that and the treatment naive. And again, the response rate was fairly impressive in this patient population. Obviously, the CR rate in this patient population was lower, somewhere around 50% compared with what we saw in the treatment naive patient population.
Next, we sat down with Carol Moreno, MD, lead author of the Phase 3 Illuminate trial, and a senior staff member at the Hospital de Sant Pol y Santa Creu in Barcelona, Spain. Eligible patients with CLL or small lymphocytic lymphoma were randomized to receive continuous ibrutinib daily plus obinutuzumab or chlorambucil plus obinutuzumab. Data from the trial revealed a 77% reduction in the risk of disease progression or death with the ibrutinib combination versus the chemoimmunotherapy combination in patients with CLL or small lymphocytic lymphoma.
So ibrutinib, you already know, is the BCL-2 inhibitor, which has been approved for patients with CLL. As a single agent, ibrutinib has shown impressive results in terms of efficacy and safety after 7 years of follow-up. The recommended first treatment in patients older and or those with comorbidities are either single agent ibrutinib or conventional chemoimmunotherapy with chlorambucil plus obinutuzumab. But we already know that patients with high-risk features or those with a mutated IGH3 gene have a suboptimal outcome under chemoimmunotherapy. So therefore, in the Illuminate study, we investigated whether the addition of inotuzumab to ibrutinib will improve progression-free survival compared to conventional chemoimmunotherapy, chlorambucil, and obinutuzumab as first-line therapy. We also aim at prospectively confirm the superiority of ibrutinib plus obinutuzumab over conventional chemoimmunotherapy in patients with high-risk genomic features. The design of the trial, this was a randomized trial in which patients were eligible if they were previously untreated, they had previously untreated CLL and required therapy according to the IWCLA guidelines, and patients were randomized to receive either ibrutinib given continuously in combination with obinutuzumab for 6 cycles, which are given intravenously, or chlorambucil for 6 cycles in combination with obinutuzumab for 6 cycles. Well, the results are so impressive because what we have seen is that the combination of ibrutinib plus obinutuzumab resulted in a superior progression-free survival compared to conventional chemoimmunotherapy. The median of progression-free survival has not been reached after 31 months of follow-up in the ibrutinib plus obinutuzumab arm, while the median progression-free survival was only 19 months in those patients receiving the conventional chemoimmunotherapy. In addition, and what is very, very relevant, is that in this study there was a high proportion of patients with high-risk genomic features. 65% of the patients were unmutated and or have high-risk features such as deletion of 11q or deletion of 17p or p53 mutations. So in this particular population, in this very high-risk population, we are seeing that the magnitude of the effect of in progression-free survival was also observed. We saw that there is a significant improvement and robust and significant improvement in terms of progression-free survival in this high-risk population treated with ibrutinib plus obinutuzumab, while the outcome of these patients while receiving conventional chemoimmunotherapy was very poor, with a median only of 14 months. The takeaway from this trial is that in addition to single agent ibrutinib, the combination of ibrutinib plus obinutuzumab offers another option to achieve a long-term progression-free survival in patients with CLL.
Jumping to multiple myeloma, we spoke with Nina Shah, MD, from the University of California, San Francisco, Helen Diller Family Comprehensive Cancer Center. Shah shed light on the phase 1 trial with the anti-BCMA chimeric antigen receptor T-cell therapy, BB21217. Researchers observed an objective response rate of 83.3% with a very good partial response or better rate of 75% in patients with heavily pretreated relapsed refractory multiple myeloma. Though these are preliminary findings, they add to the existing body of knowledge and known benefits of CAR T-cell therapy in myeloma.
First of all, I want to talk about the patient population that we studied, which is a relapsed and refractory multiple myeloma population. They had to have at least 3 prior lines of therapy and been exposed to IMiDs and proteasome inhibitors. They also had to have at least 50% BCMA expression in their bone marrow plasma cells. So with this population, you know, these are hard to treat people, and so that's why we were interested in getting these people into this therapy that we thought would be very efficacious. So far, we've treated 12 people, and we've been able to see that the safety is what we would expect from this type of therapy. 2/3 of the patients had CRS, or cytokine release syndrome. Most of this was grade 1 or 2. One person had a grade 3 event. Regarding neurotoxicity, there were 3 patients who had neurotoxicity, 2 of which were grade 1 or 2, but there was 1 grade 4 event with encephalopathy in the setting of a grade 3 CRS. This did require us to expand the dose level, and we actually ended up treating another 6 patients at this dose level. And the reason for that was that we wanted to see how much high versus low tumor burden may contribute to the safety signal. That is, do patients with greater than 50% plasma cells in their bone marrow have more chance of having a toxicity? It turned out that the rest of the patients did great and there were no other DLTs, so this looked to be an isolated event. Regarding the efficacy, it looks like we have 83% of patients responding, which is 10 out of 12. Now remember that this is the first dose that's being tested in this phase 1 trial. Some of these responses actually took a while to evolve, meaning that over time the responses deepened. In addition, the patient that has been longest followed up so far remains in remission at greater than a year, but we do need longer follow-up to understand the full efficacy. One thing that was really interesting about this particular study, as I mentioned, the purpose of it was to see if T cells cultured in a different way with potentially more memory cells in the product would last longer. And indeed, when you look at the early data coming out for T cell persistence, it looks like there are T cells detected even 9 months out, at least for the one patient that's been followed up that far. We have shorter follow-up for other patients, but we're hoping to see more mature data in the next few months to see if truly the preclinical hypothesis is proven by our in vivo correlative data. The BB21217 trial is a phase 1 trial with the endpoint of safety and tolerability. It's a standard 3+3 dose escalation trial. The results that were presented at this meeting looked only at the 12 patients that have been treated in the first dose cohort. That is 150 million cells as a flat dose. And that data was presented to look at the safety and preliminary efficacy. BB21217 chimeric antigen receptor T cell targets BCMA as an antigen, but is different from previous CAR T cell therapies in the way that it's cultured. So it uses the same construct as a BB2121, but is cultured in the setting of a PI3 kinase inhibitor so as to increase the proportion of memory-like or central memory T cells in the infused product.
Myeloma is not the only malignancy in which CAR T cell therapy has proven efficacious. Also presented at the meeting were data from a phase 1 and 2 trial, which showed that concurrent treatment with ibrutinib and the CD19-targeted CAR T-cell therapy JCAR014 was well tolerated, and it led to an overall response rate of 83% in patients with relapsed or refractory CLL. Leading the retrospective analysis was Jordan Gauthier, MD, a senior fellow in the Clinical Research Division at Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center in Seattle, Washington. Hear from him below on the study design and subsequent findings from the trial.
We've seen some very impressive results with CAR T cells in ALL and in NHL, and particularly with aggressive lymphomas. The results in CLL are not as good. We have nonetheless demonstrated that using a CD19 specific CAR T cell product called JCAR14, we could achieve some deep and durable responses in patients refractory or having relapsed after ibrutinib. So we try to go a little further, and there is actually a body of data, preclinical data, that suggests that combining ibrutinib with CAR T cells can be beneficial. So why is that? So it could be beneficial because sometimes you stop ibrutinib just before the infusion of CAR T cells or before lymphodepletion, and patients have what we call a tumor flare. The lymph nodes get much bigger. This rapid tumor progression. So by continuing ibrutinib, that might be beneficial. The other thing is that there is evidence that ibrutinib helps the CLL cells migrate from the lymph nodes into the peripheral blood, which potentially could be that would make it easier for CAR T cells to kill them. And the two last thing is that there is actually evidence that ibrutinib might improve the functionality of the CAR T cells, so improve the anti-tumor effect of the CAR T cells. And last, there's also evidence in a murine model that ibrutinib may prevent cytokine release syndrome, so a kind of toxicity that we see often after CAR T cell therapy. So this is the background. So this is a retrospective analysis of 2 sequentially treated cohorts on a phase 1-2 study. So the first cohort that we will call the no ibrutinib cohort. That's 24 patients, and all of them had interrupted ibrutinib at some point before, prior to leukapheresis or prior to lymphodepletion. In contrast, the other cohort that we call the ibrutinib, concurrent ibrutinib cohort, consisted of 19 patients, and all of them were scheduled to start ibrutinib at least 2 weeks prior to leukapheresis, up to 3 months after the infusions of CAR T cells. So the key finding is that we observed high rates of response by IWCLL 2018 criteria. 83% of patients in the concurrent ibrutinib group responded, and versus 65% in the no ibrutinib cohort. So high rates of response, and that's at 4 weeks, so early on after CAR T cell infusion. Next, we also noted very deep responses by using flow multi-parameter flow cytometry and using deep sequencing. In particular, in patients that had no disease detectable by flow, 80% of them had no disease detectable by deep sequencing. So very deep responses. And the last key finding is that in the concurrent ibrutinib cohort, not a single patient developed a severe form of cytokine release syndrome. This is retrospective data, this is not a head-to-head prospective comparison, so difficult to extrapolate too much, but we are hoping that we can confirm those findings. And there is actually an ongoing trial, which is called the Transcend CLL trial, that will try to address that question with bigger numbers of patients. And the question being, is ibrutinib beneficial combined with CAR T cell therapy in CLL? We see differences, but we don't know why this differences happened, and we'd like to understand more the biology underlying these findings. And in particular, we looked at the cytokines that closely correlate with severe cytokine release syndrome. We observed that these cytokines are at much lower levels in the concurrent ibrutinib cohort, which may provide a bit of a hint as to what is going on. But much more research should be done, and up to now, the short answer is that the exact mechanisms are unknown. Obviously, it's a bit harder to find room for CAR T cells because CAR T cell therapy is a complex therapy. Venetoclax and venetoclax-based combinations can lead to very good results, to deep responses, durable responses as well, particularly when administered early on in the course of the disease. So I think CAR T cells, it's still very early data. We need more follow-up, and hopefully we can find exactly where CAR T cell therapy stands for CLL. But this is a little too early for now, I think.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to the 23rd episode of OncLive On Air. Check back on Wednesdays for new interviews from our State of the Science Summits. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. We have 2 upcoming State of the Science Summits for those interested in attending. If you weren't able to attend the 2018 ASH Annual Meeting, we will be in Kansas City, Missouri on February 2nd for a Best of ASH Focus State of the Science. We will also be hosting a State of the Science Summit on February 28th in Nashville, Tennessee on hematologic malignancies. Register now at onclive.com/meetings/SOSS. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at @OncLive and @OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.